Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha Marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. For reference purposes, this show is being recorded on the morning of Thursday, August 27th, 2020. My guest today is Michael Guyad. Michael is somewhat of a renaissance man in the financial services space. He runs the ATAC Rotation Fund, tickers ATACX and ATCIX, which is a mutual fund that executes a risk-on, risk-off tactical asset allocation strategy through the use of exchange-traded funds. The fund is up nearly 60% year-to-date, making it one of the top-performing funds in any category. ATAC is part of the broader Toroso Investments family, which includes Tidal ETF Services, the 2019 ETF.com winner of Best New ETF Issuer Award. Previously, Michael served as the co-portfolio manager and chief investment strategist at Pension Partners LLC, an investment advisor managing mutual funds and separate accounts. In addition to everything I just mentioned, Michael runs the lead lag report here at Seeking Alpha Marketplace. Designed to help investors anticipate market corrections and volatility through his award-winning research, subscribers to the Lead Lag Report receive daily detailed risk analysis along with tactical investment opportunities. The service is currently offering a 14-day free trial. Go to seekingalpha.com and type Michael Guyad, that's G-A-Y-E-D, or the Lead Lag Report into the search bar at the top of the site to learn more. As if all of this wasn't enough, Michael is a social media superstar with more than 100,000 followers on Twitter. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree with a double major in finance and management at NYU Stern School of Business and became a CFA charter holder in 2008. Anyway, enough introduction. Welcome to the show, Michael. It's a thrill to have you here.
Yeah, no, appreciate it. You definitely made me feel like I'm a renaissance man, given everything you just said.
Yeah, it's quite the resume, although I do hope that listeners will be more interested in what you have to say than what you've accomplished so far,
sure.
As impressive as it is. So first of all, congrats on the incredible performance of your ATAC rotation fund so far in 2020.
Yeah, we'll get into it, but it's I always tell people that every asset class, every strategy has a cycle it does better or worse in. And yeah, I always tell people that it's not really about me or the strategy, it's about the cycle favoring me, favoring the strategy. And yeah, we'll get into that, but I think that's kind of an important aspect of thinking about how to invest and kind of keeping humility, you know, at the forefront.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess let's just start at the beginning. How does the strategy underlying the fund look exactly, and how did you come up with it?
One of the things you I think had mentioned is the award-winning research in the Lead Lag Report that drives the Lead Lag Report. And what that award-winning research is or relates to is around these four white papers that won four separate awards, each of which I presented on all over the country, and each of which in some way, shape, or form alludes to or relates to the ATAC rotation fund. Now, the common thread across all these papers as a philosophy, which goes into the fund, is this idea that I may not know the exact mile marker that I might crash my car, but I do know the conditions that favor an accident. I know when it's raining to slow down, play risk off, when it's sunny to speed up, play risk on. And in the context of markets, there are leading indicators that help to identify the conditions under which volatility is likely to rise or fall on a going forward basis. I always like to say on Twitter that, you know, everyone is always obsessed with this question of what's your call? Oh, your call is wrong or your call is right. Rather than say, what are the conditions which drive probabilities, which drive outcome, right? I always, you know, I'm a very big believer in this idea that all I do is really try to give voice to math. I'm essentially a weatherman trying to say, here's what the conditions are that favor risk-seeking or risk-averse behavior. And to do that using, you know, quantitatively proven historical indicators to risk. The 2014 Dow Award paper documents one of these quantitatively proven indicators, which is the relative price performance of utilities against the market. So 2014 Dow Award paper documents this anomaly, whereby historically, when you go back to the 1920s, when the utilities sector, most boring sector of the stock market, when that's outperforming the broader stock market on a short-term basis, generally you tend to see stock market volatility rise on average afterwards. So in other words, utilities typically move first, then you tend to have higher risk conditions. One of the stats in the paper shows that in the top 1% of VIX spikes, those real collapses in equities, like what we saw earlier this year, you know, historically utilities are already leading 83% of the time. So there's something about utilities that tell you about risk conditions, and it's not a random correlation. The reason that utilities are so crucial to watch, the causation there, is really around interest rates, right? Utilities are the most bond-like sector of the stock market. Their movement tells you a lot about changes in the demand for capital and changes in growth and inflation expectations. Historically, when very long-duration treasuries outperform intermediates, a form of yield curve flattening, you have the same kind of phenomenon. Generally, stock market volatility tends to rise afterwards. And most major crashes, corrections, and bear markets are preceded historically by strength in utilities and treasuries. So very simplistically, everything I do around the lead lag report and everything I do in the ATEC rotation fund is around this idea of track the behavior of utilities, of treasuries, in the case of the lead lag report, of lumber relative to gold, moving averages, things that can tell you about potential interest rate changes. And then if those areas are suggesting you're entering a risk-off scenario, to position in advance before it's too late through either low beta or, in the case of the ATAC rotation fund, in treasuries themselves.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, you hear a lot of analysts say when equity markets and credit markets are disagreeing with each other in terms of the signals they're sending out, usually go with the credit markets there. It's also interesting, one would think that in terms of the flight to safety, people always talk about a move to utilities and treasuries as a response to increased volatility in equities. And yet your research has shown that that actually starts flashing signals before the volatility shows up on the equity side of the ledger. So,
right. So it's anticipatory. Exactly right. And now there's an important point of that, which is I think missed by a lot of people. You know, aside from the fact that it's proven in the white papers and it's not based on my opinion, it's just purely data that on average these are leading indicators to risk and to the accident in markets. The thing which I think is missed in the way people view markets is that just because you slow down entering a storm, or just because you're seeing a storm ahead of you, doesn't mean you're going to have an accident or you're going to crash, right? So it's not like every time utilities and treasuries outperform, you are guaranteed to see a volatility spike. It's that when you have a volatility spike, you tend to already see strength in utilities and treasuries, or you tend to already be in a storm, right? So with hindsight. So the point is that I think, you know, I think a lot of people incorrectly view investing or signals in general as this kind of holy grail way of trading, disregarding the role of false positives in slowing down entering the storm and never having that accident, which is why it's so critical, by the way, that the way you execute in a risk-off period or the opportunity set you're using in the risk-off period is the right one, meaning because you're going to be wrong a lot. Every time you drive and you slow down, you're inherently wrong that you have an accident because the odds favor you get home safe. Because you're going to be wrong a lot playing defense, tracking indicators that can flash red quite often, it's very important to be able to use investments that allow you the ability to be wrong and still make money. So what do I mean by that? If you're risk off because utilities and treasuries are telling you to be risk off, and it's a wrong signal, it's a false positive, meaning it warns you the conditions were there, the outcome was not. When you're in that kind of scenario, if you're shorting, you lose money one for one, right? You're wrong, right? The market keeps going up.
Yeah.
If you're in cash, you don't have any chance of momentum. However, if your expression of risk off is low beta, is high dividend, is treasuries, you might be wrong, but you could conceivably still make money because it's not a perfect inverse correlation playing risk off in those types of investments. And I think it's a really, really important point because everybody always wants to bet on direction. To me, it's more about bet on conditions and execute with the assumption that you're going to be wrong much more than you're going to be right. Of course, when you're right, you're really, really right, right? Which is, I think, the story of the ATAC rotation fund. But in between being really, really right and missing it, you've got to still be able to survive long enough to be right.
So I'd like to get into that story a little more in terms of how it's played out in 2020 so far this year. If you could break down exactly what has worked, what's driven those impressive returns, I think it would be really instructive for listeners. And of course, you're not going to tip your hand right now in terms of what you're holding, but it's already on the record that you were very long small caps a few months back and then prior to that. So what sorts of positions were most profitable for you?
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to this point about, you know, alpha and real outperformance doesn't really come from the upside, it comes from the downside, right? If you have a risk on, risk off strategy, and all of the papers document this kind of variations of risk on, risk off, all of those backtested strategies in those papers that are referenced in the lead lag report substantially over long periods of time outperform everything. Not because it's participating as much on the upside, it's really about the downside part of the equation. And I always tell people that if you have a signal or strategy that thrives on down capture, you've got to be in a cycle where there's downside to capture. And that cycle obviously came through, you know, this year. So broadly speaking, what happened this year is utilities and treasuries began to outperform, really signaling you might be entering risk off in the case of the ATAC rotation fund. Mid-January.
Yeah, I'm guessing as the coronavirus story started to enter the mind of bond investors or more risk-averse investors, people that were looking at China and saying, is this really going to stay localized in China while markets continue to fly higher, obviously, at that point?
Right. And you know, it's interesting you say that, right? Because the signal for the fund came in the Friday before the headlines starting really hitting on the weekend about, you know, the first U.S., you know, kind of case that was kind of percolating.
Sure.
But to your point, it's not like it was a new, you know, that's why I think Nassim Taleb, you know, calls this more of a gray swan rather than a black swan. It's not like it was really unknown. It was known. It's just the market didn't care about it until it cared about it. Right. So, but utilities and treasuries did care about it as markets were still rising. So they started outperforming. Fund went into long duration treasury ETFs. The mutual fund uses a combination of utilities and treasuries. The lead lag report, I show them on individual levels with a slightly different look back period. So the signals often correlate, but not necessarily one for one. So even for a lead lag report subscribers, the official risk off started really January 27th. The fund was a bit earlier because it uses a slightly different set of rules, but same concept. So it went into treasuries mid-January. Now, usually when utilities and treasuries are not in a false positive, meaning when they are right that you have a volatility spike, usually it's within 2 to 3 weeks. It's not like you have this sort of long lead time where their outperformance is warning you of an accident. But in this case, actually, it took a while for the accident to take place, meaning utilities and treasuries kept on staying strong from mid-January on, and you know, then obviously COVID happened, the crash happened, and that's why at least the first phase of the fund's performance came from the risk-off side, right? Being in treasuries before it was too late, avoiding the entire COVID crash, and as much as that was a very aggressive decline in markets in the first quarter, I would argue that was a very traditional risk-off period, meaning stocks fell, credit spreads widened, treasury prices rallied, and utilities and treasuries did what they historically do, which is they got ahead of it. That's classic from a lot of perspectives. And by the way, even for those that are subscribers, you know, even the lumber and gold signal flipped. I think it was around mid-February, saying risk off. So staying in treasuries, then March. And now, for anybody that's been tracking me on Seeking Alpha, you know that I wrote a piece February 27th saying we may be in a crash, and here's why. And I was saying that because the way that utilities and treasuries were warning and suddenly spiking indicated we were in a true positive where risk was manifesting, that you might have a crash. Markets crashed, but then early March, I started making the case that towards the end of March, you might see a melt-up, a risk-on, a COVID bubble. And I was saying that based on quantitative metrics, looking at historically how long utilities and treasuries have typically outperformed for before you have a risk-on period, and that was sort of at the end of March, is sort of the tail end of when most risk-off periods last, is about, you know, a month and a half, 2 months from when the signal got flipped. And for the fund rotated to risk on March 31st. So utility started weakening, treasury started. So sold out of its treasuries went, initially all in large caps, then initially from large caps to small caps. As the reopening narrative picked up, momentum persisted from small caps to emerging markets to treasuries, to where it is today. But you can see mathematically, that's why the fund is up, as of this conversation, nearly 60%, because mathematically, that's how it works, right? You avoid a major decline for stocks. You're in treasuries before it's too late. You make money as stocks go down, being in that flight to safety moment. Now you've got more capital to compound off of, so that when you rotate back risk on at lower equity prices with that higher capital, with leverage, with small caps, with emerging markets, hopefully as tailwinds, that's how you can really have a monster year. But in order for that type of behavior to take place, you have to be in a cycle where whipsaw risk is less, which goes back to the point that if you have a strategy which thrives on down capture, you've got to be in a cycle where there's downside to capture.
Yeah, sure. And obviously timing is key here. Also, I follow a bunch of different momentum and trading signal type strategies. And most of them, you didn't really see risk on telegraphed until the end of April. So you seem to have called that a full month earlier than many other people, which obviously when you really pick the bottom in the way that you did and really kind of pick the top to de-risk also, that's going to really juice your returns in a certain way.
Yeah, and I'll tell you real quick on that point, it wasn't just sort of the quantitative aspect to it. I've been at this game for a long time, whether it was writing for MarketWatch or writing with Seeking Alpha for a long time. And it's always interesting to me to see comments on writings. And in the midst of the decline, when I had gotten it right, being risk off and the fund was doing well, and I was doing segments on Bloomberg saying, we're going to survive. It's not the end of the world. And I was saying that based on just, the at the time, what I argued was perhaps the true positive of a fiat system, which is that you can print money to the point where if the Fed needed to literally, print money out of thin air to give it to pharmaceuticals to find a vaccine, right? When you don't have any constraints, you can manipulate the incentive systems tremendously to create, a vaccine to fix or somewhat resolve this. So yeah, there were a lot of things I was making a case of as the Dow was crossing 20,000. But the other part of that was in the kind of comments on the articles themselves, there was such overwhelming belief that this was the big one, that this was the end of the world. And I've seen this before in the midst of major declines, when people are so convinced of one direction, that we're about to see a contrarian move, right? Which is why I even put that tweet out in the midst of the decline. Opportunity always exists when the crowd thinks it knows an unknowable future. Again, I don't know the future, but I know that if everybody thinks they know what the future is, I want to bet against that. Right, that's where there are mispricings. So there were a lot of things, even from a contrarian standpoint, given how dark the sentiment was, that suggested we're probably going to have a very big move. And by the way, that dark sentiment was reflected also in policy response, with the fact that the Federal Reserve, in attempting to save capitalism with socialism, decided to buy up corporate munis junk debt.
Yeah,
with the fact that you ended up seeing checks being given out by the United States government. By the way, it wasn't the U.S. that started that, it was South Korea, right? That started kind of giving people checks just to stay at home. So, there was such an overreaction to sentiment-wise, not to downplay COVID by any means, but just an overreaction to the idea that this was, the apocalypse, that you almost had to have a setup for a bubble in the event that it was not an apocalypse. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think psychologically, if you want to delve into it a bit, the difference this time versus maybe Great Recession, where in many ways the financial system was at much greater risk, is that you're not only dealing with a financial crisis, you're dealing with a health crisis. And so I think that kind of messes with people's thinking. They see loved ones getting sick around them, or they see the numbers of people dying every day on the news. And it's got to mess with people's psyche in a way that maybe other recessions don't, where as terrible as things might have been in 2000 or 2008, you think to yourself, all right, I'll still be alive at the end of this. But in this case, I think at least in the early stages when people didn't really realize that, this doesn't kill every single person that gets it, et cetera, I think it was really messing with people's psyche. And I think that really did bleed into some of the really extreme negative sentiment that we saw back in February and March and April.
Yeah, and adding to that, you know, it's in many ways it was that fear that and that feeling that I think was permeating from the news reports about what was happening and all these statistics on people dying, these pictures of, you know, morgues and I'm in New York and seeing kind of, you know, turning the Javits Center into potential hospital, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I think in many ways that fear also is what made it less severe than all the models at the time were predicting. Right. Listen, the fact that toilet paper was being sold out and hoarded, the fact that, you know, early March, I would go to CVS, you know, before any lockdowns really took place, and the soap bar was empty. I mean, the crowd actually reacted very aggressively. And you could even see that in Netflix trending movies, because the movies that were trending were Walking Dead, Pandemic.
Yeah.
There were a couple other cameras, but they were all movies around, you know, either something that's apocalyptic or something that's viral. Right. So it was interesting, right? Because people then, I think, from a almost like the availability heuristic, people started immediately going to the extreme, the low probability, and using Hollywood as the model for what the future would look like. And that resulted in a lot of people taking actions to I think I would argue, just from crowd fear, to start staying home earlier than the policymaker said, to start wearing masks or be, you know, socially distant before the policymaker said. So as much as I critique sort of the overreaction in many ways also kind of, I think with hindsight, you know, probably saved a lot more people than not. But at the same time, that overreaction was the opportunity in asset markets.
Sure. And congrats to you that you were able to recognize that so early on.
I'm speaking with Michael Guyed of the Lead Lag Report. Designed to help investors anticipate market corrections and volatility through Michael's award-winning research, research he utilizes in running the ATAC Rotation Fund, subscribers to the Lead Lag Report receive daily detailed risk analysis along with tactical investment opportunities. The service is currently offering a 14-day free trial, so what are you waiting for? Go to seekingalpha.com and type Michael Guyed, that's G-A-Y-E-D, or the Lead Lag Report, that's LEAD-LAG report, into the search bar at the top of the site to learn more.
So I'd love to take a step back here and discuss a couple of pieces that you penned on Seeking Alpha. You wrote one back in April titled The Greatest Disconnect Between Stocks and the Economy in History. You followed that up with another piece earlier this month titled The Greatest Disconnect Between Stocks and the Economy Continues. So I'll start with a simple question. Considering everything you lay out in those pieces, and we can get into it a little bit, what is going on with markets at this point? The fact that we've made new highs, not only in the tech-heavy NASDAQ, but in the S&P 500, I think is probably surprising to a lot of people, myself included. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of make sense out of the market action from those March 23rd lows through today.
So I think there's a couple of things, right? So first of all, I want to attack the perception of what the market is. And I always rant on this point, right? I get it, right? People say, okay, market's at new highs, the S&P, the NASDAQ. Personally, I don't think 30 stocks from the Dow is the market. I don't think 500 stocks from the S&P is the market. I don't think the NASDAQ's the market. I don't think the five stocks that are driving people's perceptions of the market, the FANGs, are the market. The truest definition of the quote-unquote market is all risk assets. Right, that you know, kind of work off of similar sort of risk factors.
Yeah, sure. Although, I mean, just to step in for a second, and I totally agree with that. But if you look at the move over to passive indexing in the last 20 years or so, a higher and higher percentage of investors are really just putting their money into those benchmark indexes or, you know, some of the Russell indexes. There's less stock picking going on than was happening. So I totally agree with your broader point, but I think it might be somewhat semantic in that I think more and more investors really are looking at those benchmark indexes, not just because that's what shows up on the news, but because that's what's sitting in their 401k or in their brokerage account.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think a lot of that is also just because it's just straight up performance chasing, right? Momentum typically begets momentum, and momentum is a factor, and there's momentum in factors. So there's momentum in momentum, which is why large caps have gotten so much traction.
Attention. Sure.
But I'm saying that only from just to give perspective, because the reality is when you look at most stocks are still negative for the year. Russell 2000, you know, small caps, which are much more reflective of the U.S. domestic economy are not at new highs, right? So you still have a lot of damage, I think, to undo, despite sort of the concentrated momentum that's really been primarily in large cap tech heavy areas. Now, I talked to a lot of advisors. A lot of advisors talk to me. They're interested in the ATAC rotation fund. They're interested in the lead lag report. And everybody has the same sentiment you have, right? And I think a lot of listeners have, which is none of this makes sense. And which I agree with, except if you put on the view, which I think is accurate, that it makes sense because it's being manipulated. And let's call a spade with this, okay? The fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the Fed decided to save capitalism and socialism to the point where they are buying up ETFs, junk debt ETFs, corporate risk ETFs, they have clearly decided that they want to manipulate this higher because they view stay at home and COVID as, you know, pretty much the greatest deflationary shock you could imagine. Never mind the fact that the real reason you have deflationary shocks is because you have so much debt in the system that they've encouraged, which, you know, we'll get into, I'm sure. But, you know, it makes sense from the standpoint that, you know, it's the old adage of don't fight the Fed. And everyone is basically just, you know, saying, well, if the Fed can print dollars and just manipulate this higher, then it becomes a self-fulfilling momentum trade and everyone else just starts investing alongside the Fed. So I think from that standpoint, you can argue it makes sense. I think it is wildly damaging longer term because I'm sorry, that $600 government stimulus check is nowhere near the trillions of dollars that was added to the stock market for asset holders who probably don't need that stimulus check to begin with. You know, it kind of widens the wealth gap, which exactly is that great disconnect between the stock market and the economy. And I think this is where the Fed is really going to, at some point, run into some very serious problems. I don't think Powell is stupid. I think Powell recognizes that the Fed has to keep on jamming stimulus into the system because this, you know, I've said this before in the media, this to me is like a home construction project with COVID. It's going to take longer and cost more money than anybody thinks. That's the best way to sort of describe, I think, the way this is playing out. And I think the Fed recognized that. The problem is, what can the Fed do other than try to talk down markets to some extent to give them time to try to jam that stimulus into the system rather than have that stimulus go to the casino, right? Which you've seen, by the way, with some of these, you know, Robin Hood, you know, no commission type of traders who are literally buying bankrupt equities.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the casino, but I will say here straight up that I took my stimulus checks. I still thankfully have a, you know, full paycheck and just put them straight into the stock market when indicators turn positive because I didn't need the money. So why not put it to work?
Which is interesting, right? Because that goes back to sort of the, you know, are stocks reflective then of the economy? If the money and stimulus isn't going into the economy, but is going into stocks to drive up valuations, then the stock market clearly is not being, you know, reflective of the economy. Now, people will correctly say the stock market is never reflective of the economy. I agree. You know, it used to be the case that the stock market was a discounting mechanism of the future, was a leading indicator of the economy. The problem is really ever since the 08 financial crisis, the Fed viewed the stock market not as anticipatory of the economy, but as a driver of the economy through the wealth effect, right? Through trying to push equity and asset values higher, through the manipulation of rates lower to try to spur over demand in capital. So, and I think that's sort of, you know, what's happened here, which is why there is such a disconnect, because the philosophy now is that the stock market is what's going to save the economy, not the other way around.
Yeah, sure. That all makes a lot of sense. I'd love to get into a little bit more in terms of those two pieces that you wrote. You discuss at length in both of those articles the inherent weakness of the capitalism that we currently follow here in the U.S., and you just alluded to the situation since 2008 and the Great Recession. To quote one of your articles, just so listeners can understand what I'm talking about, and I'll post the links to them in the write-up of this show so that people can go read them in full. But so you wrote earlier this month, more than 30 million Americans are unemployed, demand has contracted, and the economy is tanking, but we have a couldn't care less because the stock market is zooming. The current NASDAQ fear and greed index are way higher than the one recorded during the dot-com bubble mania. No complaints, but this dichotomy is reflective of our twisted capitalist structure. please diagnose what you see as the current disease plaguing American capitalism.
To me, it's almost more of a philosophical, maybe existential type of question. And I've always wondered this, and I think it's worth having debate over. And I know there's, it's probably over my pay grade in terms of understanding a lot of the nuances in what I'm about to say, but I've often wondered if democracy and capitalism can coexist properly. So what do I mean by that? When you have a fiat system where it's not tied to gold, where there's the ability to just print dollars, there's no discipline in anything, right, as far as spending. And when you're in a country or a system where a democracy where you get elected by promising more, I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, it's all about promising more. All that ends up having the result of is more and more debt, right? And when you look at all of these sort of broader aggregate debt statistics, almost all of them really started accelerating aggressively once you got out of the gold standard. And you ended up having, I think, in general, sort of a more lax way of viewing, you know, fiscal and monetary policies. I remember very, very well Greenspan had done an interview when he was first promoting his book, The Age of Turbulence. And he said he never once had a single politician ask him to raise rates. They all said to him, you got to keep lowering rates, right? So, and I get it because, you know, if you lower rates, the interest expense is lower, which means you can borrow more and you can promise more and you can get elected more often, you know, depending on whatever party you're in. So my point in saying that is the disease is around the lack of discipline on the fiscal and monetary side. And you can't blame them only from the standpoint that discipline doesn't get you elected. So, you know, I don't know when, and I don't think anybody knows when, this will all come home to roost. This tremendous debt and sort of feeling that you just keep on borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. And I don't know when it's going to matter, but it's going to matter at some point. And I would argue it's even starting to matter, you know, societally, in the sense that, you know, the more you have a lack of discipline, the more debt you have, the more concentration of wealth you have, not just among the top 1% and the rest of society, but also even around FANGs and, you know, the top 5 stocks that drive the market relative to everybody else, because they can benefit the most off of these incredibly low rates driven by this incredible amount of aggregate large debt. So the disease is actually making things more and more distorted, right, in terms of the removal of the middle because of a lack of discipline. I don't know how it gets resolved. It does concern me as a member of society that we have entered this bizarro world where nobody seems to think or care that borrowing from the future matters. So let's just, there's no debt ceiling limit. It just keeps going. You're never going to be able to grow out of this. So, and I've made this case on Seeking Alpha before, that you only have one of two ways out of all of this debt and leverage in the system. You either have hyperinflation, which, good luck, I think it's hard to get unless you get somehow a forced increase in the velocity of money. Or you have what I think is the more likely scenario, which is everybody defaults to the Fed. Both are nasty scenarios, and both are very ugly for what is supposed to be a capitalist system.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I don't think that our election cycles, which are every 2 years in the House, every 4 years for the presidency, really allow for long-term strategic thinking. I mean, you could obviously argue downsides of, let's say, having a single 10-year term for, let's say, the president, but I think it would at the very least allow them to really plan in the longer term and not worry that they were in campaign mode at all times, because it really makes it impossible, I think, for any kind of strategic long-term planning.
Right. And it just keeps on compounding on problems. And I think that's why the Fed will never really be able to raise rates in any meaningful way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that Japan example and then the example of Europe, I think it's exactly where the U.S. is right now also.
Right. Now let's kind of run with that a little bit. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to have a no return equity environment, right, for U.S. markets. I think everyone always uses the example of Japan to say, listen, they've gone nowhere for whatever since 89 when it peaked.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about the fact that the Nikkei was at 40K in 89 and hasn't been either. I was just thinking about the fact that they have perennially low rates, both on credit and also of growth, and that every time they have any slight downturn, they're back in a recession again because they've issued so much debt that they've just killed long-term growth.
Now, that does bring up an interesting point too, right? Which is that given that, you know, that seems to be our immediate and near-term and long-term future, what do you do from an investor standpoint with bonds, right? Because yields are not compensating you for those two scenarios, hyperinflation or default. They're not compensating you for anything, for any kind of risk. And that's a function of, you know, the sort of policies that have zombified a lot of these debt markets.
Yeah.
You know, they're just walking dead, right? As far as, you know, the Fed buying up junk debt and again, munis. So what does an investor do? Now, I'll tell you that this is what I think is kind of intriguing about what's happening here. And I talked a lot of investment advisors, and this is partially why there's interest in things like the ATAC rotation fund, because I think most people recognize that bonds are troubled. So what do you do with your bond yield portion of your portfolio? Well, you can do one of two things. Either you take on more risk to increase your absolute level of yield, which means you're taking on more credit risk. Well, if you take on more credit risk, you're not really diversified against your stocks because credit risk is just beta. It's the same thing, right? Credit spreads widen when stocks fall and vice versa. So that's not a diversified portfolio. So you can either take on more credit risk, which just makes you more concentrated in your risk that you're taking, or you go into more alternative diversifier things like gold, like Bitcoin, even like the ATAC rotation fund. You try to find those things that kind of march to their own beat that are not as dependent upon a pure risk on passive beta cycle. Now, admittedly, that's hard to do because there are very few strategies and asset classes that give you that true diversification benefit. But if this is sort of our future, this is, I think, the thing everyone has to wrestle with is how do you construct a more robust portfolio where everything is acting off of the same risk factors if you follow the same old 60-40 model of years past?
Just actually, my last episode spoke with Nancy Davis of the Eyeball Fund, and she seems to have actually developed a strategy there, which is bond convexity play, which is totally non-correlated to both credit, equities, gold. So there may be some creative solutions out there, but yeah, by and large, I agree. Within capital markets, it's kind of everything correlates to one to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that's why I always say, you know, I think diversification now comes less from asset class and more from strategy. Now, but that does go into a discussion around cycles too, right? Meaning that, you know, which is goes back to whipsaw risk. Every asset class, every strategy needs a cycle, right? So the cycle of old was very clear. Pure passive beta, volatility doesn't really last for very long. And, you know, you can take risk in anything and probably make money. Maybe that's still going to be the future. I find it hard to believe because, you know, again, with the sheer amount of leverage in the system, the only question that matters is inflation or deflation, which means more risk on, risk off, which should mean a cycle where there's more downside to capture to allow for strategies outside of ATAC, you know, and ATAC itself, obviously, to hopefully have a better chance than had been the case in the past. You know, for me, kind of going back to the fund, I started the fund end of 2012. Highly tactical risk on, risk off strategy. I've branded myself as this tactical thinker that focuses on, you know, risk conditions. So what happens if you're in a cycle where there's no risk? Then on Twitter, they say, hashtag, you suck, right? Because yeah, you're wrong so many times. Your strategy's not working. Your signals are broken. Well, maybe, or maybe it's just the cycle doesn't favor whatever anomaly or whatever philosophy you have in a moment in time, and maybe you're going to enter a cycle where it starts to. And this is kind of the interesting thing I think about, you know, the way people view even this construct around passive and active. For passive to work, you have to have active, and for active to work, you have to have passive. It's known as the Grossman-Stiglitz paradox. You can't have one without the other. What ends up happening, and I think what's happened the last several years is, to your point about everybody going into large caps and the S&P and indexing that way, everyone has gone into, or a large degree of people have gone into passive because active had not been working for so long, because all those opportunities largely got arbitraged away from being productive. It's probably why hedge funds themselves have underperformed so dramatically for so long, right? Because whatever anomalies they were tracking just went away. So what happens is as money flows into passive, there's less money looking at active opportunities, looking at downside, looking at anomalies, which means that those opportunities, those anomalies, because there's less dollars chasing and looking for them, must by definition get larger. So at some point, that pendulum swing towards passive S&P only, very smooth beta, gets to an extreme. And because no one else is looking at the active side, that's when the active opportunities are greatest. I think to some extent, this year is kind of the proof of that, you know, as and the ATAC rotation fund is the reflection on that, because yes, nobody could see a pandemic coming, but nobody can see any fat tail coming, any black swan coming. But if you've been slowing down entering the storm for a number of years because the conditions said a tail would be there, you've been vilified until finally the accident happens.
Yeah, and then you look like a genius at that point. I mean, of course, you're not stock picking here. You are taking passive funds and then you're getting active with the passive. So it's kind of an active passive strategy. And I'd love to dive into the details of that a little more. I think listeners of this show will be very curious as to what your fund selection process looks like. So for example, just perusing Morningstar, I was looking at the last available holdings of ATAC rotation fund. And as of May 31st, you were holding, and this is going to be an order of position sizes, four different small cap funds. iShares Core S&P Small Cap, ticker symbol IJR, Schwab US Small Cap SCHA, ProShares Ultra Pro, Russell 2000 ETF, that's obviously leverage, URTY and Spider Portfolio S&P 600 Small Cap, SPSM. Why hold four different small cap ETFs? And then furthermore, how are you selecting these four funds and not probably another two dozen funds that are relatively similar that are out there?
So it's kind of a different beast, I think, in the way the fund works than I think most probably would think through unless they've, you know, had conversations or have heard me in the past. So yeah, again, it's risk on, risk off, either all in equities or all in treasuries, right? Utilities, treasuries, risk off. If they're outperforming, the fund goes all in treasury ETFs. Usually long duration, can be short duration, but for the most part, I think as everyone knows, when you're entering one of these so-called risk-off periods, you want that flight to safety potential that longer duration treasury typically give you, which is what happened, again, mid-January. Now, on the risk-on side, a couple of things. First of all, the fund purposely is always levered a little bit, 1.3 times when risk-on in equities. And the reason that it's leveraged is that...
And you're, sorry, just to be clear, you're using ETFs to achieve that leverage.
Right. So it uses a leverage. So basically 85% of the portfolio is unlevered ETFs. The remaining 15% is the 3x.
Okay. You're not selling swaps or anything on the side.
Right. Right. Exactly. It's always ETFs on that. So it's using the leverage ETF to achieve that on a very short term basis. So the reason that a little bit of leverage is used is, and this is documented in the 2016 Dow Award paper that I co-authored, it's called Leverage for the Long Run. So the finding in that paper, Leverage for the Long Run, is that generally when you're in low volatility periods, you have more streaks in day-to-day performance, meaning you're 3, 4, 5 straight up days in a row in low volatility, which makes sense even from a behavioral finance standpoint, because when you're in low vol periods, you tend to have more underreaction, which causes more drift, more momentum, more up days. Now, whereas if you're in high volatility periods where there's a lot of seesaw action, it's called the constant leverage trap. That volatility kills your returns if you're leveraged. So
sure.
Inherent in the main signals, utilities weak, treasuries weak, risk on, lower volatility, the idea is that if you're in a low vol regime, you might as well leverage up a little bit into it. So that's why it partially uses some leveraged ETFs when risk on.
Just to be clear here for listeners, because I think, you know, the general warning on products like the ProShares Ultra Pro Russell 2000 and you know, direction funds, other 2 and 3 time levered products, is that you're not supposed to hold them too long term because compounding can eat away at those returns. Again, that risk is really pronounced in back and forth markets. When you essentially move in the same direction, it's much less of a concern in those cases.
Yeah, exactly right. So although there is a lot of evidence that still suggests that if you do a buy and hold of a 2x or 3x, that you can have enormous returns longer term. The problem is you could have a 80% drawdown,
correct,
right, in between then. So it's just more of a risk return component. But the idea is to try to sort of time the leverage to some extent in conditions. It's kind of like, you know, when can you go over the speed limit? Likely when it's, you know, sunny and there's not much traffic in front of you, right? It's the same kind of argument. Now the opportunity set is purposely limited. So when it's risk on, the ATAC rotation fund, it's either going to be one of three areas. It's either going to be 1.3 times large cap ETFs, 1.3 times small cap ETFs, or 1.3 times emerging market ETFs. And the decision in terms of those kind of broad buckets is based purely on relative momentum. So if, for example, small is outperforming large and emerging and it's risk on, fund's going to be 1.3 times small cap ETFs. If the week afterwards, it's still risk on, but emerging markets are showing the best relative performance, rotates out of small goes 1.3 times emerging market ETFs. If utilities and treasuries the week after are saying risk off, back to treasury ETFs. So it's much more about sort of the larger buckets. The construction of the underlying holdings is really just a function of trying to go for the lowest fee, largest ETFs that track broadly large caps, small caps, or emerging markets. And that's done purposely because, you know, whether the fund's at 50 million, the mutual fund, the ATAC rotation fund's at 50 million or 500 million, there's no liquidity concerns because it's like a fund of funds, right? It's a mutual fund trading around ETFs. So it's a pass through to these ETFs that have billions of dollars in assets. It's not so much about sort of the construction. It's always of the underlying ETFs. It's always core. It's more meant to represent sort of the larger play of those assets. The reason that emerging markets are in there is traditionally when you're in a risk on period and the dollar is strong, small caps benefit the most. Traditionally, when you're in a risk on period and the dollar is weak, emerging markets, the small caps of the world, benefit the most. So even from that perspective, there's a bit of a kind of currency play. Now, the other part that's important to this, so again, it's limited to just three areas with these types of ETFs. It goes back to cycles. The last 3 years, whenever small caps looked like they were going to run, it would start, momentum would pick up, and then everything goes right back to the fangs. Last 10 years, every time emerging market momentum looked like it was about to pick up, you're in this purgatory of death by a thousand cuts.
Back to the U.S.
The dog just don't hunt.
Sure.
Right, back to U.S. every time. So, and the reason I'm saying that is, you know, some people will look at the fund and say, you know, you've had some years which were not that stellar. Okay, I understand that you never had risk off with a risk on, risk off strategy. But, you know, why couldn't you participate, you know, in the pure U.S. side? Well, it's because if you're in a cycle that only favors U.S., in these short-term rotations, you still have plenty of signals, false positives, playing momentum in small caps that doesn't hold, playing momentum in emerging markets that doesn't hold, right? It goes back to whipsaw risk, right? And whipsaw risk is, again, dependent upon cycle. Now, the last many years, several years, I'd even argue the last decade, it's really been a story of mega caps, and you haven't seen any real alpha from small caps or emerging markets. I don't know if the next 10 years are going to be different. I don't know when the cycle changes. The only thing you can say with certainty is that every day that goes by, you're closer to the prior cycle ending, whether that means tomorrow it ends or a year from now or 5 years from now. Every day that goes by definition, you're close to regime change that might favor small caps and emerging markets. Whenever that regime change comes, I'm hopeful the ATAC rotation fund can really benefit off of it because it means less whipsaw risk. And it really, this is kind of a point I think a lot of investors underappreciate. No matter what you're in, the likelihood of success is not really based on your trading skill. It's really based on the macro environment you're operating in and these mega trends in some of these broad buckets like large caps, small caps, and emerging markets.
So I'm curious about the typical holding period for the funds holding. I think you mentioned some kind of a weekly review. And then on top of that, you know, according to Morningstar, the annual turnover is more than 2,000%. How do you tax manage a fund like this? Is this something investors need to be concerned about? Is this really meant to be held predominantly in non-taxable accounts?
Yeah, the anomaly of utilities and treasuries only lives in the short term. Right, meaning that it's only when utilities and treasuries give you this kind of burst of strength where the risk-off conditions might manifest. So that means that all of this is short-term capital gains in the context of a mutual fund. Stay tuned on an ETF.
I was going to say, because if it was an ETF, you could have those in-kind transactions and really limit it. But in a mutual fund, I don't see you avoiding cap gains here.
Yeah, again, I'll say stay tuned, not as it relates to this strategy, but there are some plans that I have with the you know, Toroso, the advisor to the ATAC rotation fund.
I was going to say, yeah, your involvement with Toroso has to, I would assume, involve an ETF in the not too distant future.
Yeah. So, but going back to the mutual fund itself, so it's all, you know, short-term capital gains tax. It's better for tax deferred accounts. I have a lot of people that use it in taxable accounts because they like that it can be aggressively defensive, meaning all in treasuries when they need it the most. And Yeah, presumably if you're paying taxes, it means you're making money, right, for the most part. But yeah, better for tax-deferred account.
Well, sure. But yeah, I mean, just to sharpen that up a bit, you know, you're talking about here, and I totally agree, outperformance over a full market cycle. But I think, you know, the research overwhelmingly shows that if you're paying a higher share of taxes over a full market cycle, then you will underperform in the long run. Because even though you have those great periods of outperformance, you're paying short-term gains, and then in the underperformance, you're still underperforming as much as anything else. So
yeah, I agree, but also depends on your definition of performing, right? So it's not just about the absolute return; it's also about what you're getting, what you're giving up. You know, not just in the tax, but also in terms of higher volatility by not being in that strategy that might be taxed, that might lower your overall volatility. Right? It's not just about return; it's about
sleeping well at night, as they say.
Right, and to have that kind of diversifier element to it. And you know, but you know, where I was going to go with this is that it's interesting, right? Because everyone always focuses on after-tax returns and, oh, you know, tax efficiency. Yet, you know, the average holding period for most investors in any stock now is like 5 months. You know, the last stat I saw, you know, mutual funds used to be held for 4 years. Now they're held for, you know, under a year, right? So as much as, yeah, and I get it, right? You have to talk about the tax implications. In practice, it seems like almost nobody's really managing their own portfolios for taxes, given how actively people trade. And I you know, you put the fault on that. I think that short-termism, I think, is partially, you know, driven by sort of this kind of fast money approach that, you know, I'd argue, you know, mainstream media typically puts in when it comes to markets, as well as, you know, commission-free trading. And I've ranted on this point before, you know, with the amount of focus there is on these brokers that, you know, allow you to trade completely for free, it's actually very damaging to investor returns, not just because it's more likely that they do something that's, you know, taxable, right? Because it creates a temptation to overtrade, but also because typically overtrading results in longer term underperformance from a risk and return standpoint more often than not, right? So it's always kind of interesting, I think, to have that discussion, because I think there's a lot of sort of other, you know, real-time things that are happening that almost make it seem like nobody seems to be caring about those points, even though I agree with you, they should.
Totally. Yes. And you know, I think that's clear. And you look at all kinds of different studies and papers on this. Performance in funds of individual investors, you know, in those funds is much lower than the performance of the funds themselves. So individual investors manage to buy and sell at the worst possible times. Of course, there is a risk to being too inactive also. So this idea, if you just set it and forget it and, you know, kind of just push money into a mix of assets over time, you'll have incredibly good performance. You know, I think there's times when markets are just clearly overvalued, and to continue pouring money into them thoughtlessly without looking at what your expected returns actually are, I don't think is a great strategy either. So I'd love to get into that a little bit. We're looking at, in the last week, new highs on the S&P 500, on earnings multiples that are somewhere in the range of 30 to 40% higher than when the SPX made those highs back in February. The NASDAQ 100 already made those new highs a month and a half ago. And so I'm wondering what your outlook is for equities at current valuation levels.
Yeah, can I tell you in 2021?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's... I always joke about that. I was like, I'll tell you, it's like, are we going to have a summer crash? I'll tell you in the fall. Look, I you know, I don't think valuations matter at all. I really don't.
Something reasonable I don't think expected returns on a given asset class at a given point in time.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, the real person to ask is Powell, right? Because the expected returns clearly are being, if it's not based on valuation, it's not based on, you know, the economy, then it's based on manipulation, which kind of goes back to the earlier point. So, you know, look, I find it hard to believe that you're not going to have another risk off period. I think very likely what's going to happen, the scenario I've laid out since May, is a situation where bonds collapse first to reflect rising reflationary pressures, that absolute yields start to rise. I think we're starting to see that, by the way, as of this conversation, that bonds become where the initial big pullback comes in. So stocks could still do relatively okay in that or hold in. So expected returns will probably be low to flat in that period. And then afterwards, on an overreaction of a bond market sell-off, you'd then have a stock market, you know, pullback collapse of some sort to just reflect an overreaction to the cost of capital and the realization that, you know, things are still not that great, broadly speaking, for the system. So, you know, it's always hard to say, you know, well, the S&P is going to be higher than where it is today or not. the only thing I can be confident in is that I think there's a lot more risk on, risk off swings to come. I know that's self-serving to say that, but I find it hard to believe you're going to re-enter this just pure passive beta environment.
Sure, yeah, and your fund obviously should stand to benefit nicely from that. And then on top of everything else we've been discussing, obviously there is an election coming up, which can certainly add additional volatility into everything else we've been discussing, the virus and the reaction to it by the Fed. So definitely the kind of conditions that I think can favor additional outperformance by a tax rotation fund. For listeners of the show who want to understand more about your fund screening process, so you had hinted at or alluded to the fact that you're looking at things like liquidity. And I'm just wondering what kind of screening process you have that produces those ETFs. Are you looking at minimum assets under management, minimum tightness of spreads? How are you evaluating it to decide, okay, it's these four funds and this fifth one doesn't make the cut?
Given the nature of the ATAC rotation fund in terms of how aggressively it rotates, you know, a almost $300 million, you know, the fund going risk on, risk off, or rotating around risk on, liquidity is paramount, right? I have to make sure that I can get in and out of these broad buckets, you know, quickly and efficiently without any sort of, you know, significant slippage in doing the trades. So liquidity is critical. So for me, it's always really around the underlying holdings, and then obviously the size of the fund, which is off the ETF, which is really what drives liquidity. And I think it actually brings up an interesting kind of side discussion, which is that I think when it comes to ETFs, people get liquidity wrong, meaning that they think that an ETF that is not trading a lot is illiquid, that does not have a lot of volume is illiquid. That's not necessarily true, right? Because what matters is the underlying that the ETF is tracking in terms of that liquidity. And as long as you put limit orders, you know, you can always kind of manage the bid-ask spread if it's, you know, not sort of trading as often. But from my perspective, if you're going to try to, you know, run a strategy like this, which is all in, all out, you've got to go for the biggest ETFs, the cheapest ETFs, the most active in terms of daily trading volume, just to give you tighter spreads in general, so you can do market orders where you need to allow for those types of rotations to take place.
Yeah, sure. And I was going to say, you can look at things like average spread, but if 20% of the time the spread is much wider than the average, that's obviously not going to be helpful to you. If you need to trade in the moment, you can't wait for the spread to tighten there, obviously. So that makes sense in terms of the overall consideration.
Yeah, although, you know, it's unfortunate that people feel like they have to trade like that exact second and they have to get that exact price, because, you know, the reality is, again, most outperformance really doesn't come from the exact price that you're trading at. It's more about how much lower your price is when you went in those volatility periods, again, the risk off periods, right? It's kind of like the bulk of, again, it goes back to the point that the bulk of our performance doesn't come from scalping or trying to get a penny here and there. You know, it's really about getting the broader asset class decision right, you know, especially in those high volatility periods.
Sure. Anyway, Michael, this has been really awesome. I think it's been great to hear both your perspectives on the economy, your diagnosis of what's wrong with American capitalism right now, and then how you actually go about running a fund that's delivered just incredible recent outperformance. And I assume because of outperformance like this over a full market cycle, has a very good shot of delivering real alpha or beta or whatever you want to call it to investors. The bottom line is they'll have more in their portfolio at the end of the day than they will in a less successful strategy. Just curious if there's any parting shots you'd like to leave our listeners with here.
Yeah, I always use this line, you know, and I always like to end off with this way of thinking about investing, right? Your ability to stick to a strategy matters more than the strategy itself. Right, your ability to stick to a strategy matters more than the strategy itself. I think a lot of people get sucked into narratives around investment themes and asset classes and past performance, when in reality, what determines an investor's individual performance is they're sticking to that particular theme or investment or asset class. And that really is why it's so critical to not benchmark everything against the S&P. Because the great joke about buy and hold is that nobody really holds when everything kind of craters, yeah. Right? So you've really got to reflect on your own risk tolerance, your own desires and your own reaction to temptations to trade, rather than try to find the best strategy or best approach. The best strategy and best approach is the one that you're going to stick to.
Sure. And of course, this may seem obvious, but you need an approach or a plan to begin with. And, you know, it's helpful to write it out or to have something explicit, because I think so many investors go out and they don't even really have a plan. It's just kind of whichever way the wind moves them on that day. So sticking to a plan is key. Having a plan is something that I think a large percent of investors don't even really have. So before you can stick to one, you really need a plan to begin with.
Exactly right.
Anyway, I'd love to help investors that want to research everything we've been discussing further find you online. Obviously, they should be following you on Seeking Alpha. You put out free content there. Let's, I guess, just start with social media. What's your Twitter handle for people to follow? And then maybe other key web addresses like ATAC Fund or where they can find these white papers that you've authored online.
So on Seeking Alpha, obviously, you know, look up my name, Michael Gayad. Check out the Lead Lag Report itself on Seeking Alpha. Twitter's at Lead Lag Report. You know, Instagram and Facebook, everything's at Lead Lag Report. I'm kind of, you know, branding myself as much as I can around that service. As far as the mutual fund itself goes, it's available on most platforms. You can take a look at ATACfunds.com. I encourage everybody, if you're going to take a look at the fund, to read the FAQ section. Don't just try to chase performance, chase process, understand the thinking. And, you know, I spend a lot of time communicating this approach, so don't ever hesitate to reach out through info@ATAC Funds. And I'll tell you right now, most likely it's going to be me responding.
Nice. That's great. Anyway, Michael, I wish you continued success this year. I wish you health and sanity, because I don't think things are going to get back to normal in 2020, unfortunately. Hopefully, this won't continue on for too long, but I think we still have a bit of ways to go here, and hope we can do this again sometime soon.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
We just finished speaking with Michael Gayad of the Lead Lag Report here at the Seeking Alpha Marketplace. To learn more about the Lead Lag Report and to start a 2-week free trial, type Michael Gayad, that's G-A-Y-E-D, or the Lead Lag Report into the search bar at the top of the site. For disclosures, Michael Gayad is manager of the ATAC Rotation Fund. The fund may own some of the ETFs that we discussed. He is also the publisher of the Lead Lag Report on Seeking Alpha. I, Jonathan Liss, am long VOO and QQQ.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast.